Well, this morning, we are going to be continuing our time in Nehemiah by looking at chapter 3. And we're going to be looking at it in its entirety with that. So it's going to be a fun little time with that. But just a little kind of quick reminder, what's going on is we're going to be looking at the wall being built. We're not looking at it being completely built today, but we're looking at the building project. And we've seen Nehemiah, the burden that's been on his heart since the wall of Jerusalem has been down and just rubble for hundreds of years. And his heart is broken about this. No one's done anything about this. And he stepped out in faith as he went to the king, even though he definitely could have been punished, could have been put to death for the audacity that he had to come forward to the king about this. Yet God was at work and turned the king's heart. And not only did the king give him permission to go ahead and do this, he gave a stamp of approval and gave him the resources in order to accomplish this. And it's been amazing to see how strong and faithful Nehemiah has been about this. The opposition has no foothold to stop him in this endeavor. So much that he reminded the two main characters that we've seen in the opposition, Sanballat and Tobiah, and Jeremy reminded us last week with that as we ended the idea in chapter 2, verse 20, when he said, "Then I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we his servants will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." God is at work doing a mighty thing right now. And as we look at this today and look at what's going on, we're going to look a little bit at the wall itself. We're going to look at the builders, but ultimately, once we understand the wall that the builders are working on and see the builders more so for who they are, we can see a wonderful example of how we can live and build the same way. But it'll be a really cool thing because just like Jeremy also reminded us, this is a great opportunity when we do this kind of stuff to brag on God. And so you guys are going to have to bear with me because we're going to read the chapter in its entirety. For those of you who've never looked at this, it is a long list of names. It's a long list of Jewish names. And so it's going to sound like that I might just be speaking in tongues. I'm not. But I've been reading over this for weeks, getting ready exactly for this moment because I knew I would. I'm still probably going to mess up every now and then, but bear with me. I'm going to try to say as confidently as I can with that one. So if you're able to follow along with that one, so Nehemiah chapter 3, starting in verse 1, says, "Then Eliashib the high priest rose up with his brothers the priests, and they built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and set its doors. They consecrated it as far as the tower of the hundred, as far as the tower of Hananel, and next to him the men of Jericho built, and next to them Zachar the son of Imri built. The sons of Hassanah built the fish gate. They laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And next to them, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, son of Hakkaz, repaired. And next to them, Meshullam, the son of Berechiah, son of Meshezabel, repaired. And next to them, Zadok, the son of Bana, repaired. And next to them, the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles would not stoop to serve the Lord. Joiada, the son of Paseah, and Meshullam, the son of Besodiah, repaired the gates of Yeshana. They laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And next to them repaired Melatiah the Gibeonite, and Jadon the Moronathite, and the men of Gibeon and of Mizpah, and the seat of the governor of the province beyond the river. Next to them Uzziel the son of Harhiah, goldsmiths, repaired. Next to him Hananiah, one of the perfumers, repaired, and they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Next to them Rephaiah the son of Hur, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired. Next to them Jediah, the son of Haramoth, repaired opposite his house. Next to him, Hattish, the son of Hashabniah, repaired. Melchijah, the son of Haram, and Hashub, the son of Pahath Moab, repaired another section of the Tower of Ovens. Next to him, Shalom, the son of Halahesh, the ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired, and his daughters. Hanan and the inhabitants of Zanoah repaired the valley gate. They rebuilt it and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars, and repaired 1,000 cubits of the wall as far as the dung gate. Malchijah, the son of Rechab, the ruler of the district of Beth Hakharam, repaired the dung gate. He rebuilt it and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And Shalom, the son of Kolhoza, ruler of the district of Mizpah, repaired the fountain gate. He rebuilt it and covered it and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And he built the wall of the pool of Shelah of the king's garden as far as the stairs that go down from the city of David. After him, Nehemiah, the son of Azbuk, the ruler of half the district of Bethzur, repaired to a point opposite the tombs of David, as far as the artificial pool and as far as the house of the mighty men. After him, the Levites repaired. Rehum, the son of Bani, next him, Hashabiah, the ruler of half the district of Keilah, repaired for his district. After him, their brothers repaired. Bavi, the son of Hendad, the ruler of half the district of Keilah. Next to him, Ezer, the son of Jeshua, ruler of Mizpah, repaired another section opposite to the ascent to the armory at the buttress. After him, Baruch, the son of Zebiah, repaired another section from the buttress to the door to the house of Eliashib, the high priest. After him, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, repaired another section from the door to the house of Eliashib to the end of the house of Eliashib. After him, the priests, the men of the surrounding area, repaired. After them, Benjamin and Hashab repaired opposite their house. After them, Azariah, the son of Messiah, son of Ananiah, repaired beside his own house. After him, Binui, the son of Hendad, repaired another section from the house of Azariah to the buttress and to the corner. Palal, the son of Uzziah, repaired opposite the buttress to the tower projecting from the upper house of the king at the court of the guard. After him, Pediah, the son of Parosh, and the temple servants living on Ophel repaired to a point opposite the water gate on the east end and the projecting tower. After him, the Tekoites repaired another section opposite the great projecting tower as far as the wall of Ophel. Above the horse gate, the priests repaired, each one opposite his own house. After them, Zadok, the son of Immer, repaired opposite his own house. After him, Shemaiah, the son of Shechaniah, the keeper of the east gate, repaired. After him, Hananiah, the son of Shelemiah, and Hanan, the sixth son of Zaleph, repaired another section. After him, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, repaired opposite his chamber. After him, Malchijah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired as far as the house of the temple servants and of the merchants opposite the muster gate and to the upper chamber of the corner and between the upper chamber of the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants repaired. You guys get all that? Right? Everything tracked perfectly, right? Yeah, that's quite a bit. I'm going to say, I think I pronounced it better this time than I did the first service. To say, so what are we saying? So I got a little graphic here I want us to look at. There's some aspects of what we just looked at that I kind of want to break down for certain reasons. But I know it's kind of hard to read, but this is probably the best graphic that I had without getting all the other little things in here. There's a few other reasons why I like this one too. I'll point some things out because I doubt most of you guys can read that print right there. But if you notice, we start off in verse 1 with a certain location, the sheep gate. In verse 32, we ended with that same location, the sheep gate. So what Nehemiah is doing right here is he's going all around here explaining what is happening in the rebuilding. So the sheep gate is one of the northernmost gates right up here. And what he did is he step by step talked about every point along the way, going all the way around here, ending back up at the sheep gate. And he went literally in that order. Nehemiah literally connected the dots in this and showing us how the wall was rebuilt. He showed us every single step, and he went around there addressing every single person as if he himself walked the entire expanse, knowing every single party that was involved in repairing this wall. I know it's kind of hard to pick up right off the bat. I had to read it several times and just be like, oh, duh, that's what's going on here with all that, because you're focused so much on all the names sometimes, or at least I was, I should say that. But one thing I want is I want to focus on really quick with this, because as I was looking at this and I was trying to understand just what the gates are about that, because I didn't know too much before I looked at this, but there were some people who try to add some additional symbolism to what these gates, the purpose of these gates, I should say. And we don't really have anything in scripture to support that. And so I don't want us to add an additional form of symbolism, but I do want to explain, you know, why they're called these or why they're given these names. And ultimately, the reason why they have these names is because they're related to their intended purpose as to why they're there in the first place. And so just in the same order that he gives, we're going to go in the same way. So starting up, again, the northernmost, the sheep gate. Well, the sheep gate is also the gate that you go through to get to the temple. It's closest to that. Now, it's called that ultimately because you're going to bring your sacrifice that you're going to take to the temple through that gate. And so it's a very important thing. You're going to take your sacrifice for your atonement to the temple. There's a reason why the priest worked on it. This is the only gate that was consecrated. The only one that is dedicated to God is this one right here. Because it is very important. The priests, the high priest, saw how important this was. So he did that. We see this gate referenced in John chapter 5, verse 2. When it says Jesus and his disciples pass by this, and then this is where they encounter the invalid at the pool of Bethesda. Now, again, the invalid was trying to get in to the pool of Bethesda. He said people kept going before him because they believed an angel would come down and stir up the water. And if you were the first person to get in the pool after that happened, then you'd be healed of whatever ailments you had. And Jesus told him to pick up his mat and go. And for this is the only reason why I can try to think, I'm not justifying it, but the only reason why I think they might try to add some additional symbolism to the gates, as if these gates and being around them would add more to your spiritual well-being, because the pool of Bethesda is by the sheep gate, which they had that belief that it would actually physically heal you with that. It's the only thing that personally I can wrap my mind around with that. But again, it's the sheep gate because you would literally most likely bring sheep through that gate with that one on your way to the temple. Then the next one in succession with this one would be the fish gate. And you do that too. Well, if you're going to bring your sheep through the sheep gate, you're going to bring your fish through the fish gate. And as a lot of commentators said, and this is a phrase I think we need to bring back, fishmongers would come through that one. And that just stuck out to me because I'm like, I've never said that phrase ever in my life. I think we need to bring that back. I'm not a fisherman. I'm a fishmonger with that one. But anyone, if that was their job to procure fish and bring that, they would bring it through here, which means that the fish market is most likely right there. With that one, that is the main place. So most of them who are getting the catches, most likely in the Sea of Galilee or the Mediterranean, they would come through there. And it's not specified for this purpose, but the fish gate is referenced in 2 Chronicles chapter 33, verse 14 in particular. They just mention that they're at the fish gate there, but it doesn't mention the intended purpose with that. But then the next one in order is the gate of Yeshana, or the old gate. Now, some people believe that it's called the Old Gate because, and this is just what some people are theorizing with this, that it goes back to the time of the Jebusites, which if that's the case, that would be pretty much the Canaanites that David kicked out of Israel, which means that if this is the case, that gate has been around for 500 to 600 years. So it very much is an old gate, which means that they knew how to build stuff back then. So given that name, then the next one, we're going to skip this one. We're going to come back to that one last, actually. And I'll explain why when we get to that. But this one, the Valley Gate, we see that reference actually last chapter. That was the gate that Nehemiah entered through when he came through to inspect the condition of Jerusalem before they began their project with that one. And then just the Valley Gate because it leads well to the valley. And then down here, the Dung Gate or the Refuse Gate, depending on your translation, is literally where you would exit out to take your refuse, take your trash. You're heading towards the dump. So the Hinnom Valley is south of here. And that's pretty much where the city's dump was, or the landfill with that. And that is actually also referenced in 2 Chronicles chapter 33, verse 6. We see King Manasseh, who is not a good king, very bad king, actually, down in the area, which is now their current land, current at this time that we're reading, their landfill area, King Manasseh would actually have child sacrifices in this valley. So yeah, very bad king. Now, but we do see all these areas that are referenced here. And then not too much further up there, we see the Fountain Gate, which we see by the, not too far from the Pool of Shiloh or the Pool of Siloam, which is where we see Jesus heal the blind man in John chapter 9 with that. But the Fountain Gate is where they would go to get their source of water, fresh water, essentially. Now, it sounds like that doesn't make sense because up north we have the Water Gate. How come they're not getting their water around the water gate and down by where the fountain gate is. Well, the water gate is near where the actual water source was tunneled into the city. And so it's not the gate itself is a gate where water's coming through, but it's right next to the water tunneling system that is entering the city that would then come down to the fountain gate area where you would actually get the fresh water from. So all these things, very simple with that one. It's like, hey, if I'm coming into the city to get fresh water, I'm going to go through the fountain gate. Makes perfect sense right there. And then on the next one above the water gate, we have the horse gate right here. Now this is in between the temple and the palace. And we see a reference in 2 Kings chapter 11, verse 16, as the horse's entrance. This is where the king's horses, the royal horses, would enter the city through. That one, or as I like to call it, the war horses will come through, because that was pretty much their main intended purpose at the time. The king's horses, they were meant for the army, for conquering. And then we have the east gate, and I've seen a few different ideas on this one, whether it's actually at the temple or it's on the wall itself with that one. Now, some people believe that this might be the same eastern gate that is referred to in Ezekiel 44 that is to be closed until the Messiah returns. That one, it's not the eastern gate that is at that you can see when you go to Jerusalem right now. This eastern gate would be underground now. But that eastern gate right there is called the eastern gate because it is the gate directly east of the temple. So again, very literal meaning with that one. And then the last one that Nehemiah lists here in this chapter is the muster gate, or muster, not mustard, muster gate, or the inspection gate. It is a military inspection type of gate right there. Some believe that in Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 2, this might be the same gate referred to as the gate of Benjamin, where we see Jeremiah himself is put in stocks at. And so, and it could very well be that the gate of Benjamin is a different gate altogether, because Nehemiah doesn't list all the gates right here in this chapter. Later on in chapter 8, we're going to see this guy, the gate of Ephraim, referenced during the Feast of Booths. And just as he did right here, lists all these in succession in the correct order going all the way around. In chapter 12, he's going to list it again in the same succession between the gate of Yeshana and the Valley Gate. So I just wanted to point out that there's nothing beyond their intended purpose as to why they have these names. They're used as points to identify areas that everyone has worked up to. This group of people worked to this point, to the fish gate. Some of these gates were newly built. Some of these gates were rebuilt. Some of these gates were simply there and didn't need to be adjusted, according to how Nehemiah explained it. They're simply points for us to identify and help us see that every single point along the wall was rebuilt. Not a single point was neglected. The entirety of that. So, the next slide. We see the wall itself is a total length of 2.5 miles. It is roughly 40 feet in height, roughly 8 feet wide, with the one exception of the broad wall, which is 71 yards long and 23 feet wide. But aside from that, this whole thing, roughly 40 feet high, 8 feet wide, 2.5 miles long, and these people completed this project in 52 days, which we're going to see in chapter 6. 52 days it took them to do this. Now, I don't know how many of you guys drive back and forth between here and Logan, but there's a stretch of road that they've been working on for like, it feels like 3 years or something like that. I was going to say, don't even pick that part. Pick any road in Utah, I guess, probably at that point right here. And just a chunk of road to do 2.5 miles, 8 feet wide, 40 feet in height, in 52 days. Man, tell me God isn't at work in this. I must say, I can't hear any excuse as to why not. That's a pretty awesome project that they did. Pretty awesome project that they completed with all of that. And so let's look at the builders more so to understand who it is that's doing this, who's finishing this project. The way Nehemiah broke this up, we see 41 little groups or parties of workmen, of a workforce. We see the phrase next to over 20 times in this, whether it was next to him, next to them. He's showing that there is all these different types of people who are working alongside one another to accomplish the same goal. And we're going to see there's all different types of people with different skills, different backgrounds. All these uniquely different individuals are doing the exact same thing in unison. Now we see the highly religious, we see the priests, we see well-known political leaders and other rulers. We see outsiders, people who don't live in Jerusalem, who came a ways away, who aren't going to stay in Jerusalem, are going to go back to their home region. We see varying socioeconomic levels of people. We see different types of skill sets, a lot of blue-collar type of workers. We see merchants, we see perfumers, we see goldsmiths. Even identifies women working in this, which to do a project like that, that's not something they did back then. The type of work that is going on here, all different types of people. Not once do we see stonemason. You don't see construction, anything to identify a background in construction. And it doesn't say the specific type of task that they did and how they built the wall. It's simply that they came together to build it. They were all filling whatever role they needed to in order to get this wall built. Now, hold on to this, but I just want to identify a few things that have us, to have this in our minds, and then we'll come back to this. But the first person that we see mentioned is the high priest Eliashib. So again, high priest, a very important, prominent character. In fact, we're going to, in chapter 12, verse 10, we identify his grandfather as Jeshua. And we see back in Ezra, starting in chapter 3, that the same Jeshua was also a high priest. So we have Eliashib, who is a high priest, who comes from a lineage of high priests. So he knows very well what it means to fulfill this role. Well, what does that mean? We'll hold on to that thought. We'll come back to that. But I want to identify that here. We see notable rulers that are identified. We see two particular ones who are rulers of half the district of Jerusalem, two more that are rulers of half the district of Keilah. We see even more who are rulers of their entire districts going on there. Now, we don't know fully the scope of that, how many people, but they rule a large portion of people. They're in charge of them. They know what it means to be the person in charge. And some of these areas, we see some of them built, some of them repaired, and some of them also did that in multiple sections as well. We see Meremoth, the son of Uriah, was one of those people. And the one that I especially am encouraged by is the people, the Tekoites, who did that, that repaired multiple sections. We see different men and women building different parts, and there's probably different motivations there. Some of them are building across from their homes. Some of them are probably building because they really want their home to be safe. They're sick and tired of living in the rubble and the destruction that they've been living alongside. But they came together and built it to completion alongside all these others. There was no quarreling. There's no fighting, no bickering of any kind. All these different people, whether there's different intentions, different skill sets, different backgrounds, all work together to accomplish this amazing feat because they were all unified with the same goal in mind. But the reason why I want to emphasize all these different leaders, Eliashib, a high priest, that we have all these other different leaders of different regions identified, is because we don't see any of these leaders at any point try to take control. We don't see any of them come alongside, will say, thanks, Nehemiah, for getting us started. I'll take it from here. We don't see any differing of every one of them trying to take control of simply their area. There's no clashing. There's no saying, well, we're going to build the wall this way. Well, we're going to build the wall this way. We're going to make our portion of the wall the coolest section over here. And there's that trap very easy. The moment that we have a degree of authority to always want to be the person in charge. To always want to be that guy to say, you know what? I know better. The world would be a much better place if everyone just listened to me. Which, I mean, but no, we have all these leaders and they yield themselves to Nehemiah's authority. And they are working. They are doing the work themselves. Now, back when I was at Frontier School of the Bible, I actually heard a lecture on Nehemiah by a wonderful, godly man who's become somewhat of a mentor to me in a ways. I did an internship with him, and he's just a wonderful man who does a church planning organization out east. His name is Dan Nave with that, and he spoke on this, and he really emphasized the idea of the best way to lead is by following. The best way to lead is by following. And he said, and I quote, "What brings down more ministries isn't the failure to lead, but a failure to follow." Man, that pride, it can damage us so much more than we realize. Even if we're so convinced that my way is the right way, that I know how to do this better, things should be going exactly how I see fit. God has not put us in a position to lead in that moment. It's not for us to take the place of the leader at that moment. It's not for us to take charge, but to see, you know what? God's put me in a place to follow. I need to follow. He's put these leaders in a place to follow. And they did, and God did something amazing because of it. That's pretty awesome. I think we just need to remind ourselves, and it's a hard pill to swallow because we really have to examine ourselves. I know I have to examine myself a lot with that one. I'm like, man, am I making this all about me? Is this my way or is this God's way? I need to remind myself, if we refuse to follow, we'll never lead. It can't be my way or the highway. It has to be God's way always, every single time. And so how do we apply this to ourselves? Because again, regardless of their profession, their lineage, even their gender, their skill set, even regardless of the home that they came from, they all came together to do this amazing thing for God's glory. It came together with one purpose. Now I can't think of any other better imagery than we have of that, than how the body of Christ is supposed to function. United with one purpose. Even though we may not be doing the exact same thing, we should all be moving towards the exact same goal with that. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, starting in verse 12, he says, "For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in one spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one spirit. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, 'Because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body,' that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, 'Because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body,' that would not make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the same sense of hearing? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them as he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. And Paul also says in Ephesians chapter 4, 1 through 6, he says, I therefore, prisoner of the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. And then in terms of working, I love what he says in Colossians chapter 3, 23 through 25, when he says, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you'll receive the inheritance as a reward. You are serving the Lord Christ, for the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no partiality. Now, speaking of wrongdoing, during this encounter, back in Nehemiah, we see in verse 5, it says, and next to them the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles would not stoop to serve the Lord. That's how they saw it. They saw serving God was beneath them. They had to stoop down to serve the God of the universe. The degree of pride it takes to think that I'm too good to serve God the way that he's called me to. I'm too good to listen to this man who is called by God to lead us. Man, it's hard to hear. Luckily, it was just the nobles, and the Tekoites themselves were still faithful, even though their nobles wouldn't do it. The average Tekoite men went and served and built. And not only that, they were so faithful that they built multiple portions of the wall. These were people who were leaving their region, which was roughly 13-ish miles away from where Jerusalem is. Now, Cache Valley is roughly 16 miles away. That's easy for me to drive back and forth to a couple times a day if I want to. It's a little bit of a stretch to do that, but I can do it several times a day if I want to, because I got a car. Now, walking there multiple times a day, out of the question. These guys are willing to go 13 miles out of the way to go do a wonderful project and then go back. The level of commitment that it takes to do that, the devotion for that. I mean, how much of our time and resources do we really give? Usually someone says, I need some help. Well, how much time is it going to take? How far away is it? Oh, that's a 90-minute drive. Oof. That's a bit. Oh, these were wonderful, faithful men, even though that the nobles there saw serving God was beneath them. They saw the importance of serving God right there. I'm really encouraged by that. And Tekoa also, just a little fun fact, is the same region that the prophet Amos comes from too. With that one, we see more than just these faithful men as well. We see a wonderful prophet arise from that area. But we need to ask ourselves, really, what is my goal? What do I want to do? Is it about me? Am I trying to serve my needs, my wants? Man, it's very easy to get blindsided and feel like, man, serving God should go this way and this way and this way. I can only serve God the way that I want to. Well, then in that moment, it's no longer about God, it's about me. Now, God has put leaders for us all over the place. He's given us people that we need to yield ourselves to, and doing it for his glory. Just a reminder, if we're doing this with the right intention, the God of heaven will make us prosper. Now, for those of you guys who've been with us for a long time, you've seen how God has made Grace Bible Church prosper. You've seen us grow in wonderful ways. Not just this building, for those of you who weren't with us or don't know, imagine a building, or imagine this room, half this size. And that's how we started out. That was it. And to see this, now that we're at a place that we have this much space, able to do two services, this many faithful people, and the fact that we realize that we need to expand because we're still growing, because God is making us prosper. It's amazing what happens when we come together with the same intent to work for the glory of God. So I want to ask you guys this, and I want to make it very clear. This is something I've been asking myself as well. So I know Jeremy does the whole like one finger at you, three back at me. I'm like, I've been doing all my fingers back at me this week. So this time I'm going to do five fingers at you guys. But no. But I want to ask you guys something that I've been asking myself this whole week. Will you rise up and build something for God? Will you rise up and build something for God? Or will you be like these nobles right here? Be self-serving and be a slacker. Seems like an easy answer, but we really need to examine our hearts and be like, what am I really doing? Am I building or am I self-serving? I can tell you, man, if we want to build and we're not quite sure how, come talk to us. Because Jeremy has a whole bunch of projects that I keep trying to tell him, have someone else do it. And it doesn't have to be that we all do the exact same thing. For any of you guys who have done a project with Jeremy, usually all you do is just kind of stand there and hand him whatever he needs while he's doing it with that one. For me, I look more like an idiot. I'm like, hey, did you need this piece? Do you need these screws? But it doesn't have to look the exact same way, the exact same task that we all do. But if we all come together with the same intent to build for God's glory, he will make it prosper and something amazing will come of it.